Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I am your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. And today with us, we have Philip Campbell, who holds a BA in European History from Ave Maria University and a certificate in secondary education through Madonna University. He taught history and scripture for the St. Augustine Homeschool Enrichment Program for 10 years. Mr. Campbell is the author of the popular Story of Civilization series by Tan Books, which we'll be talking about today. And he recently joined the Catholic History Textbook Project. Mr. Campbell's writings have appeared in the St. Austin Review and the Distributist Review. He's also the star of the YouTube sensation History in a Minute. Mr. Campbell served, interesting enough, as the mayor of Howe, Michigan from 2011 to 2015 and has been involved in homeschooling for more than 15 years. And today we are also going to talk about his latest book from Tan Books, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. So let's start right in with Heroes and Heretics. And right from the intro, I knew this was going to be an interesting book. I loved the first line in the intro, where you say, quote, Reformation, as soon as the word is uttered, we immediately realize we're dealing with a loaded term, end quote. So
exactly.
Why is that?
Well, because Reformation is a subjective idea. It implies that there's two different agents, one that's initiating reform and one that's the object of reform. And we start asking ourselves, what was being reformed? Was it in need of being reformed? What is in the minds of the reformers? So we see that it really depends upon other questions regarding the object of the reform and what is being changed. From a Catholic viewpoint, many Catholics don't even like to refer to it as the Reformation. They will call it the Revolution instead, because that's really what it was a rebellion against the Church's authority and really the worldview that the Church had bequeathed to the Middle Ages. For Protestants, they tend to see it as a cleaning out of the house, you know, sweeping out the old junk and setting things in order. So it really much depends on what angle you're coming at it from.
Right, right. It's definitely depending upon what lens you're viewing the whole situation through. And you go further in it, and I like to cover this with those of us unfamiliar and who have not read the book yet. In Chapter 2, titled The Exhaustion of Christendom, you talk about, you know, exactly what was broken. So using the word Reformation, and you alluded to the reform that occurred that some people like to coin it as, what was reformed and why did the people at that time think there was a need for this reform or revolution, depending upon which lens you're looking through?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. The church in the late Middle Ages was definitely in need of reform in an objective sense, and I think most Catholic historians will agree with that. But, and this is a huge but, Catholics and Protestants vary sharply on what needed to be reformed. For example, I don't think you'd find any Catholic that would deny that simony is a bad thing, the buying and selling of ecclesiastical offices, and that is an abuse that should be stomped out. I don't think you would find any Catholic that thinks it's a good idea for one bishop to hold 63 different episcopal sees and not reside in any of them. That was a situation towards the end of the Middle Ages. I don't think any Catholic today would agree that local clergy should be illiterate. That sometimes happened. In the late Middle Ages, as literacy was growing, you often had a situation where, institutions changed slowly. And you'd have a situation where the literacy of the public at large advanced faster than the clergy. And so you sometimes had clerics, you know, at the village level who were, you know, fairly illiterate. These are all things that needed to be reformed. And I don't think you'd find any Catholic that would deny that. But the thing is, that's not the entirety of the church, obviously. And when the Protestant reformers approached it, they hated those things as well. But they really saw those things as being engendered by the church's faith and discipline itself. So sure, you might have a monastery where the monks were lazy. That can happen. But the reformers would take aim at that and say the problem is monasticism itself. Or they would argue that that the episcopacy itself is the problem. And so the reformers really are taking aim at trying to chuck various aspects of traditional Christian life, the structure of the church that had come down from antiquity, Whereas the Catholic reformers, and in the book, we talk about efforts to reform the church prior to Martin Luther, because there was a great two or three decades of reform going on, especially in Spain and Italy, where there was a very vibrant Catholic intellectual life, where the entire life of the church was completely reformed by zealous cardinals and bishops prior to Martin Luther. So, yes, there was certainly things that need to be cleaned up. The church is always in need of reform. But again, it goes to that question of what are you reforming? What's the object of the reform? So it really is a it really is an issue of, you know, separating out the abuses versus the actual objective contents of the faith that have been passed down. And unfortunately, the reformers tended to take aim at the latter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting question just popped in my mind, and it seems a good time to ask it here. From the way you just explained that, was Martin Luther a product of this Reformation, or was the Reformation a product of Martin Luther?
Both. He's almost like a pivot, I think. You can find all the essential talking points of the Reformation, if you will, in the public discourse before Luther, sometimes going back a century. Going back even to the Golden Age, to the 13th century, you can find Marsilius of Padua arguing points against papal infallibility and arguing against certain things that will later come to fruition in the Reformation. So a lot of these things, Luther, in a sense, is almost a product of the skepticism of his age, the skepticism against the church. But then when Luther comes, he's like the pivot that turns the whole thing around and shoots it in a new direction. And I think what made that was a combination of, you know, the timing of Luther's personality, of the advent of the printing press, which had only been, you know, it only been probably 60 or 70 years, and it was still relatively new. And the great celebrity that surrounded Luther, because he wasn't just a thinker. I just mentioned Marsilius of Padua earlier. I mean, he's a guy that's kind of writing in the pre printing press age, writing manuscripts and in Latin, and, you know, being read by a fairly small group of elites or educated people, not really filtering down to the common level.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Martin Luther gets there on the scene, he's got the printing press at his disposal. He's publishing tracts and pamphlets in German. It's being mass digested by the populace, and this great, like, cult of celebrity will form around Luther, and he relishes it. He enjoys it, being this center of the storm. And that was something very new. And so I think what Luther did is popularized the ideas of the Reformation, made it every man's rebellion instead of just a dispute amongst, you know, theologians and monks, you know, writing in Latin to each other. So I think that's where Luther is, the pivot. He turns it into every man's rebellion against authority.
Right. Now, while we're on the subject of Martin Luther, obviously in 2017, we're recording this show. It's the 500th anniversary of the posting of Martin Luther's 95 Theses in 1517. What can we gain as Catholics today from studying this period of time?
Oh, well, this is tough because there's a lot of conflicting things going on in the church. In some places, you're probably aware, Pete, I'm sure. In some places, there's celebrations, mm-hmm. Commemorating the Reformation as if it's something to be celebrated.
Right.
It's very confusing. That's one of the reasons why Tan approached me and wanted me to write this book this particular year. They said the 500th anniversary is coming up, and there's going to be all sorts of talk about Martin Luther and the Reformation, and we want Catholics to have a way to understand exactly what happened and understand the people involved. But, I mean, the Reformation is still with us. If I drive down the street in my city, you know, I'm just going to the grocery store, drive down the street, you know, First Methodist Church, next door First Presbyterian, next door Baptist,
mm-hmm.
you know, all these different churches are there. And their very presence right there in my town today in 2017 is a living testament to the reality of the events of 1517. It's essential to understand the Reformation to just understand the lay of the land in contemporary Christianity, where people are coming from, why they believe like they believe and how we got here. So just in terms of understanding where we are today, that's essential to know as well. And I think it's essential, too, from an evangelistic perspective, that when you're engaging these other Christians in conversations about the faith, to understand their traditional historical hang-ups, to understand what they object to about the Catholic faith and be able to build bridges there. So it's fairly important, both from our Christian walk perspective and just from understanding the world we live in, really.
Yeah, definitely. And it helps to look back at history to understand where we're at today. And like you said, you know, you drive down the street and the I don't know if you want to call them fruits, but the results of that are present to us clearly today. Now, mm-hmm. The one thing I wanted to look at is you cover a number of interesting characters in this book, henceforth the title Heroes and Heretics. How did you choose which heroes and heretics to feature in this volume?
Yeah, well, there was a lot more than I could possibly include, and some other history-minded people have kind of balked and said, why did you end it at 1598? The Reformation continues on to 1648, you know, with the end of the Thirty Years' War, to which I just said, yeah, but Tan wanted a book of a certain length and no more. You know, there's only so much you can do.
Right.
But really, the reason I chose the people I did, obviously there's some you have to include. You have to include Martin Luther, you know, John Calvin, these sorts of people, Thomas More. But there was others that I wanted to include because I think they exemplified the struggles or contradictions of the age, or exemplified some different aspect of the Reformation. For example, St. Edmund Campion, he's a very well-known saint and martyr, but in his day, he was not anybody important. He was simply a Jesuit priest who was, you know, bumming around England saying private mass for people and was being hunted. He was hardly pivotal characters of the era, but I chose him because his life really exemplifies or highlights the struggle that English Catholics as a whole faced dealing with persecution in Elizabethan England. Or another person is Erasmus. I gave a whole chapter to Erasmus, and that was one of the more interesting characters to write about, and I chose Erasmus because he really exemplifies a great mass of people who neither were heroes nor heretics. Mm-hmm. That is, they were somewhere in the middle with their sympathies, and we forget it wasn't just Protestant or Catholic. Those were the two poles, if you will, but there was a lot of people that sympathized with some things that were going on but weren't ready to break with the church. They had a deep fidelity to the church, even though they sympathize with some things the reformers were. And Erasmus tried to walk both sides of the line, and he was given a lot of grief for doing it. The Catholic side said, if you don't like what's going on with this reform, you should look at yourself because you laid the egg by your criticisms of the church. And Erasmus said, whatever Luther's hatching out of his egg is a totally different species than anything I'm given birth to. Luther, on the other hand, looted Erasmus because he knew Erasmus was so intelligent and erudite, but Erasmus did not go far enough. He would not follow Luther into open breach. And so Luther castigated him. And so Erasmus just catches flack from both sides. And towards the end of his life, he kind of rediscovers his Catholic piety and becomes more and more of a sympathetic figure as he gets older. But I really chose him because he exemplifies the many, probably millions of Christians who this wasn't so easy to sort. I mean, it is for us today in retrospect, mm-hmm. but, you know, living in the time, it was a little bit more trickier to sort out for the average layperson who didn't have access to, you know, didn't have access to the internet or the catechism or easy to access, you know, information. It was probably a bit of more of a muddle.
Right.
And so at any rate, that gives you an idea. I tried to pick people who I thought exemplified some of the difficulties or the particular aspects of the era.
Right. So that's great. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into some of who these characters of the heroes and heretics of the Reformation are. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. yourself here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. Today with us, we have Philip Campbell, the author of Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. And we ended last segment, Philip, talking about how you chose some of these hero and heretics. And you raised a point that I'd like to touch upon just a little bit more. And that is that during this era of time, during the Reformation, you know, we have a habit, I guess, of polarizing things, good, bad, right, wrong, heretic, hero. But there were people that trudged down the middle, and you touched upon that a little bit. Can you explain to us a little bit about some more of these people that actually rode the fence, so to speak, during this period of time?
Yeah, so I mentioned Erasmus, who was a ruthless critic of the church in his youth, and but refused to actually break from the church as the reform was going on. I would also mention, as someone on the fence, I think the other major character in the book would be Catherine de' Medici, who the last chapter is devoted to.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine she's the Queen of France, and she's destined to have a very tumultuous reign. Her husband dies when she's still fairly young. He dies in a jousting accident, and she's left with these three sons who are all too young to reign in their own right, and so she needs to kind of guide each son, hold their hands while they're trying to assert their authority over France, which is being torn apart by civil insurrection between the Huguenots, which are the French Calvinists, and with the Catholic Party, which is led by the Duke of Guise. And there's political ambition behind all of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
But she's really caught in the middle. She's a woman of no great personal religious sensibility whatsoever. Her most devoted spiritual practice was probably to her astrologer, her court astrologer. she was Italian, so she was Catholic. You know, she's Italian, Queen of France. So of course she's Catholic, but she's certainly not a saint. She holds to the Catholic faith more through convention and for I think it's political support. And she's enemies with the Huguenots, but more so because they're trying to threaten her throne. And she really sees the entire problem of the Reformation through a paradigm. And I think this is something that many Catholics today need to look at very carefully, because, you know, too often, popular media coverage of the church tends to only view it in terms of a power struggle between political factions.
Yes.
Within the church. And that's just what happens when you have a system, and it slowly creeps into becoming a two-party society,
mm-hmm.
really. But Catherine kind of viewed things that way. She viewed it as a power struggle, a balancing act, as really a political issue between two groups. And what she seems to have never understood was that there are things that do not admit of compromise, that you can't always negotiate and compromise your way out of some of these situations. And you can't solve everything by political maneuvering.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of her life, in the reign of her third son — all her sons would die tragically and prematurely — in the reign of her third son, she finally starts to see all her plans are collapsing, all the different maneuvering and posturing she's done over her reign. Everything's coming apart. And she starts to see the value of simply reaching out to the other in charity and trying to do what is objectively best without reference to political maneuvering, you know. And she sees her youngest son about to unleash a conspiracy against his opponents that she knows is going to lead to a bloodbath and recriminations, and she tearfully protests and tries to tell him that it's more advantageous to make peace and to try to just, you know, I guess it's a tired cliche, but try to build bridges, you know. And he doesn't listen. He gets assassinated. And, it all goes to pot, and her dynasty. She dies, you know, just as her dynasty is going down in blood and ending. So, I think I like to believe that Catherine learned her lesson by the end. I certainly don't know. Mm-hmm. But she's a very interesting study of someone who tries to kind of maneuver both sides of the fence, play different factions against each other, and her whole dynasty collapses. And it's really a product of viewing the church's struggles as political struggles.
Right. And even just studying this time period and going through this book, it becomes glaringly obvious. We still have it today, is that the church is filled with human beings, and we're fallible. We make mistakes.
Yes. And I want to mention the title of the book, Heroes and Heretics, was never meant to insinuate that everyone in the book is either a hero or a heretic, but rather heroes and heretics are like two poles at the ends of of a spectrum. Everybody's kind of somewhere on that spectrum.
Right, right. So yep. Looking at this Reformation period, everybody turns to Martin Luther when they talk about the Reformation, whether that's the right or wrong thing to do. Obviously, after reading your book, it becomes quite evident there are many more characters involved. And I want to cover some of those probably lesser covered characters that you speak about. You mentioned a few already, but one of them I would like to talk about is in chapter 11, titled The Visionary Pope, Paul III and the Council of Trent. So can you tell us a bit about Pope Paul III?
Yeah. So Paul III, right from the time the Reformation broke out, there was popes that were calling for an ecumenical council to address what was going on. And for various reasons that it covers in the book, it just never happened. And a lot of this was due to the unwillingness of various kings to allow their bishops to participate. For example, and this is really astounding, speaking of people who walk the fence, I want to probably, the award for this goes to King Francis I of France, who doesn't have his own chapter, but he appears in multiple places in the book. King Francis was a Catholic. He had one of the biggest reliquary collections in Christendom, but he was encouraging Protestantism in Germany. Why? Because it weakened the kingdom of his rival, Emperor Charles V. So the Catholic King of France encouraged Protestantism in his enemy's territory. It mentions in the book it will come to France, and they'll post Protestant posters in the king's royal bedchamber. And then he freaks out. Then he's all about burning the Protestants once that happens. But at any rate, Francis was one of the people who halted ecumenical council time and again because he did not want the German Protestants to reconcile with the Catholic Church, because then it would strengthen his opponent. So he would always block the attempts of the various parties to get together and stop them. And relations between Charles V and the papacy were strained after 1527 when Charles' army sacked Rome. So there was these various things that just wouldn't come together. Now, Paul was the pope who finally brought it all together, actually got the council summoned and refused to back down, actually got Trent opened. He would not live to see the end of Trent. Trent was the longest ecumenical council in the church's history. It sat for, I can't remember, 18 or 19 years. Intermittently. But Paul III knew two things. Number one, he knew this council had to happen no matter what, and he saw it through. And number two, he knew, and I'm speaking from experience here as a former politician, is that he knew that personnel is policy, that the people that you put in charge, that is your policy. That's the way you get your policy done. And one of the greatest things that Paul III did was get the right people in place to start plans for the council, to drafting council documents and things like that. He put the right people in place, and so finally the time was right, and it all came together. And he died shortly after the council started. It was like his great magnum opus that he spent his pontificate giving birth to. But then, of course, it flourished, the Council of Trent. It became the greatest council of Christendom, and very long-lasting. I think before Trent, you had ecumenical councils. I think you had two or three ecumenical councils in the century and a half before Trent. That's off the top of my head. I might be wrong. But after Trent, of course, you're not going to have an ecumenical council for 400 years. For 300, until we get to Vatican I, because the vision of Trent was so was so big and all-consuming and just grandeur of what Trent accomplished that set the Catholic world on its course until the modern age. So, and that was all Paul III's brainchild, if you will. Obviously, the Holy Spirit's helping him out, but he had the vision and knew what he needed to do and how he needed to get it done.
Right. So now I want to talk about one other one here before we go to break, and that is in chapter 14, you alluded to him a little bit earlier in today's show, and that is the celebrated outlaw St. Edmund Campion.
Yeah. Yeah. So Edmund Campion was an English exile who converted to the and joined the Jesuits, wanted to go back to England to help his co-religionists, and he had a vision before he left the seminary of being martyred. He didn't particularly want to be martyred. being martyred in England for being a Catholic priest was not a nice thing. But he went back to England, and he traveled around as an itinerant priest, just kind of saying masses for people in the privacy of their homes. And then he gets famous by publishing something called his Brag, and his Brag is this it's this letter challenging the Anglican establishment to prove their points from Scripture, and he's basically bragging like your theology can't stand up to Scripture, and this gets published around, and all of a sudden he is the biggest outlaw in England. And everybody's looking for him, and he eventually will get caught. Eventually, will get caught from some people who gossip a little too much. Word gets around where he's at, and the royal spies come and they find him. And it's really terrible how he ends up. The Anglicans make him argue, make him have this disputation, but they torture him. They'll torture him during the day, and then when he's done being tortured, he has to come out and argue, like after he's just been in the dungeon, and he can barely stand up and barely raise his hand because it's so mangled. But they're interrogating him about Scripture and all this, and he still comes off pretty well, even though he's been maltreated. if I can I read the last paragraph from the chapter on Edmund Campion?
Certainly. Go right ahead.
Yeah, and I really wanted to show the kind of conundrum that English Catholics were in. It says, quote, Edmund Campion had once wondered whether he had the constitutional fortitude to endure such a trial. Perhaps the most troubling thing about a torturous death is that the question is really moot. It does not matter if one can or cannot take it. It is happening nonetheless, and there's not a thing that can be done about it. December 1st, 1581, Campion was taken from his cell and tied to a rough wooden hurdle in an uncomfortable straddling position. The hurdle was dragged through the streets of London to the dreaded Tyburn, the place of execution. It was a grueling trek of almost 5 miles. Once at Tyburn, Campion had a noose tied about his neck and was slowly elevated off the ground. The noose constricted and crushed his windpipe until he was almost but not quite unconscious. Then he was let down, had his genitals hacked off, his body sliced open and his entrails torn, be burned before his eyes. Finally, he had his head lopped off and his body chopped into 4 pieces. His associates, Father Briant and Sherwin, suffered the same fate. And the same thing happened to 127 other Catholic priests during the reign of Elizabeth. And that's the end of the chapter. And I guess you can see there, that's just trying to say like, hey, this is life as a Catholic priest in 1587.
Yep.
That's the way it was, you know?
Yeah, and to stand up
and
for
so
your
that's
faith
why
during that time. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So
with that, we will take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. Don't let bad coffee leave you bitter. Experience the pure taste of artisan small batch coffee with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Grim Bean's whole bean and ground coffee is sourced from 90 farms across the coffee belt from organic, fair trade, and direct trade farmers. With over 20 coffee selections, Grim Bean is sure to match your taste. Single purchase and subscription services delivered to you ensure that you will never be without your favorite coffee again. Visit GrimBeanCoffee.com today for 10% off your order with the code BREADBOX at checkout. Experience the best with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. We're here today with Philip Campbell. I'm talking about his latest book from Can Books, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. Talks a lot about some obscure characters you may not have heard of. The Reformation was definitely more than just Martin Luther. But now I want to segue into the second part of this show to talk about another project of Philip's, which my wife uses, and that is the history series that you have from Tan Books called The Story of Civilization. Can you give us an overview of what this series is and how you developed it to kind of kick off our conversation about that?
Yeah, so The Story of Civilization is a four-part series, and I should mention that only parts one and two are in print at the moment. Yep. Part three will be out in the spring. But it's a four-part series of world history. It's probably aimed towards, I'd say, middle schoolers, although you can get some traction out of it with high school and elementary school, depending on how many components of the program you're using. But it tells history, really focusing on a narrative format. It gives you all the pertinent facts and people, of course. But each chapter has a historical fiction story in it, kind of a dramatized account of what it was like to be in that time or place, or be that person in history. So you have stories about being at the Battle of Cannae with the Romans, or being in ancient Egypt, or sitting through a sermon of Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, and just being at all these different places throughout history, and try to kind of break open the story, the narrative aspect of history, because history is a great big story, and I really wanted to encourage kids to think of it that way and not as like, oh, I got to memorize these dates. You know, I want them to think of it as a narrative, as a story. And so that's how it's presented. And so it comes with, you can get it with various components, with a test book, answer book. You can get it with an audio book, which is good for like younger kids. Mm-hmm. So I use it in my household as well. My seventh grader uses it, but my second grader also listens to the audio stories and gets a lot out of it. So it's just a really great narrative focused history program.
Yeah, we had an opportunity. I've reviewed both My wife has reviewed both volumes of that on my blog over at Patheos, the Catholic book blogger. She uses both of them. And the big thing that I think's really neat about it is the components within the series itself. Right, like you said, there's two volumes, and we'll get into each of those here in a bit. But you can get the teacher's manual. You can get the test book, you can get an activity book, there's audio drama CDs you talked about, or you can get them as MP3 downloads. And if everybody listening would go to tanbooks.com and look up The Story of Civilization, you'll get a landing page for each of these volumes, and you can download PDF previews and samples from the audiobooks. A great, great resource, I think, for homeschoolers. And that leads me into...
And there's also videos.
Yes.
I don't know. Does your wife use the videos?
I'm not sure if she does or not. I believe she might.
Well, if you buy the whole program, you get access. You can go on the Tan Homeschool website, and there's a streaming where there's videos of me for each lesson, kind of summarizing the main points of each chapter, and then there's different pictures and graphics, and there's interactive quizzes and stuff on the videos. It's just really neat. There's so many components to it.
Yeah, great stuff. So that leads me into this question. Among homeschooling circles, you're a pretty well-known name because of the of your writing that you've done. And you and your wife homeschool as well. So has your work in the homeschooling field grown out of that, or how did that come to be?
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting. It started with... I wouldn't say it started in my home. I'd say it started in my co-op, where I was the middle school history teacher in my cooperative St. Augustine homeschool enrichment program in Ann Arbor. I just left there after 10 years this year because I was too busy writing books to teach anymore there, fortunately. But I was there teaching middle school for 10 years, and I got recruited from there by Homeschool Connections, who were just starting at the time, and they said, we need a history teacher, and they're like, hey, you, Mr. Campbell, you teach history, right? Why don't you come teach for this little startup thing we're doing on the computer? And I was like, computer classes, what? You know, that'll never go anywhere. And so they recruited me, and I started teaching online. And, of course, Homeschool Connections took off and got huge. And now they're like the cutting edge of online Catholic education. And I've got thousands and thousands of students. And that is what brought me to the attention of TAN. And they were thinking about doing this project, and they were, thinking about what PhDs can we get, what, eminent historians can we get. And they were kind of picking Mrs. Whitman's brain. Mrs. Whitman is the founder of Homeschool Connections.
Yep.
And she says, no, you don't want a PhD. You want an actual middle school teacher to write. You want someone who actually talks to kids on a daily basis. And they're like, do you know anybody? And she says, well, yeah, talk to Philip. And so they came to me, and I sent a chapter in, and they loved it, and we've been working together for several years now, and it's really great.
Awesome stuff. So let's go through each volume a little bit and give people an idea of what it is you cover. So volume one of the series covers the ancient world, and you look at the beginning of history through Emperor Constantine. One of the areas covered are all the ancient civilizations of the world, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Persia, Greece, Rome. And that's a lot of ground to cover. How much research did it take to compile, just this one volume of material?
Well, there was a lot, but this kind of grew out of Homeschool Connections. Like, I had taught for years, I've taught ancient history several times, Greek, Roman history. This semester right now, live, I'm teaching Dawn of Civilization. So this was a lot of research I had already done in prep for my live classes. So essentially I was taking the research and the stories and everything that I had always brought to my live classes and trying to distill it down into book form. So the answer is, it was a lot of research, but most of it had already been done before I started writing, just as a teacher. So I was really just drawing on the treasury of my teaching experience.
Gotcha. So one of the things I think that really makes this material that you've put out here compelling and easy for kids to digest is your writing style, because it's more of a storytelling ability than a dry textbook. Obviously, I would think you're doing that intentionally, but how do you...
Sure.
What drives you to write in that way? Because most of the time, people think history, they want to run the opposite direction because of assuming they're going to experience that dry textbook.
Yeah, well, I have five kids, so I would stop and I would think, if I had to explain this to my 9-year-old, if I had to explain this, how would I begin? How would I draw him in? And I would sometimes run chapters by my kids and see if they loved, see if it was interesting. But really, I don't know. I'm going to say that some of it is second nature. If you spend, if you spend 6 or 7 hours a day talking to middle schoolers about history for 10 years, you're going to kind of develop an idea of the way you have to approach it,
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know, it's hard to say. It was kind of intuitive just from my background. But yeah, it was intentional, obviously. I wanted to draw them into the history and get them into the story aspect and learning about the people.
So another question, it's more less about the product, more about homeschooling. What brought you to the homeschooling arena? I know what did it to us. For us, was we never looked at public school as an option. We looked at parochial schools being too expensive. So the next best thing was homeschooling. So what brought you into the homeschooling arena?
Yeah, well, probably just growing up in public school.
That's where I was.
I grew up in public school. My wife did as well. And later, after becoming an adult and getting into the faith, I realized just how much there was to life that I didn't get in public school. And I guess I'd have to say, in the beginning, it was a moral, it was more of like a moral decision in the beginning. Like, I don't want my kids around all the stuff that mm-hmm. I was around, But then as I started homeschooling longer, it became more about the academics. It became more about, okay, not only is this a superior moral environment, but it's a superior academic environment as well. And I think that's what really, has provided the continued propulsion to keep it going is the superior academics of it.
And not only that, the ability to craft the curriculum, I think is a big plus.
Yeah.
For us. And
individualization.
Right. And I came out of the public school system as well. Graduated from public school.
Yep.
And one of the biggest things that I saw, and I like to joke with people when they ask about homeschooling, I'm quite honest with the answer. My wife does the homeschooling. I'm the financial backer and the principal. But the amount of time wasted in a public school setting, in even parochial school, it's amazing.
Oh my gosh, it is. And I have to say, I don't think you mentioned it in my bio, but I'm actually a licensed public school teacher in the state of Michigan. When I first got out of college, I decided I wanted to go into education, but I was young and I didn't even know about alternative education. So for me, that meant public school. So I went and I spent 4 years studying education formally at the college level. I've studied child psychology and classroom discipline and everything you can imagine, and I'm a certified licensed teacher. And I remember, even within the public school training classes, they said 30% of time gets wasted in a public school. It gets wasted with, like, okay, everybody sit down, get your stuff, okay, be quiet, sit down.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It gets wasted going to and from classes. It gets wasted with can I go to the bathroom sort of questions. And at the end of the day, it was really fascinating, Pete. They had a way of measuring the day. They would say, well, there's your actual, like, clock time, which might be, 55 minutes of class, but then there's your time on task, which is the time you're actually doing instruction. And they said, plan on that being 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And mm-hmm. that was just an astonishing amount of waste. And it really struck home to me, if you're thinking of homeschooling, you don't need to think like, oh my gosh, I gotta educate my kids 7 hours a day at the table. You really don't. In my household, we do homeschool for about 3 hours a day, mm-hmm. maybe four if it's a hard day. We have, 20-minute breaks in between, 3 or 4 hours, and then we're all doing our hobbies and cleaning up and doing our chores and getting more done and learning more. I think homeschooling 3 hours a day, you're going to learn more than sitting in a public school for 7 hours because of all the wasted time. So you are absolutely right on that.
And then you go with your kids to the grocery store and you get all the strange looks about why isn't your kid in school?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I was just at the grocery store today with two of my kids.
So with that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a bit to talk about Volume 2 of The Story of Civilization.
Alrighty.
With Philip Campbell. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box, and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. We've been speaking today with Philip Campbell. We talked in the first half of the show about his newest book from Campbell's, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. Last segment and this segment, we're covering his series, The Story of Civilization, an awesome homeschooling resource on the history of the world that he has out with Campbell's as well. We talked about Volume 1, The Ancient World, last segment, and Volume 2 is also out right now of the four-volume set that has yet to be completed. But Volume 2 is about the medieval world. And can you tell us a bit about what you cover in that set?
Yeah, Volume 2 goes from the fall of Rome up to the dawn of the Renaissance. So it's pretty broad. It's about 1,000 years and covers all the great stuff in between, the emergence of medieval Christendom and all the wars, of course, the great thinkers. And it even goes into some of the cool stuff, like there's a chapter on medieval inventions, there's a chapter on common life, living in towns, medieval farming. So it really is, it's not just the political stuff, or the religious, it's very, every aspect of medieval culture. And I think it's really the best resource for middle school age kids on just getting immersed in medieval life.
Right. Now, you said there was two other volumes, and I'd like you to, and I believe you mentioned what they were, but go ahead and tell us again what they are and when we can expect to see those other two volumes.
Well, Volume 3 has already been written. Volume 3 is on the modern times, which really is going to be from the Reformation up until the end of the Cold War. So it's only 500 years, but it crams a lot in. Mm-hmm. Got your Napoleon, Hitler, like everything in between. That one was a challenge to write. You know, it's the medieval book. It's like, okay, the Crusades, that's fun. Like, that's an adventure story. Now I got to explain, like, communism to seventh graders, and that's a bit more tricky. But that book is already written. We are putting the finishing touches on the manuscript now, and I expect it to be in print probably April or May. And after we get over the new year, I'm going to start writing Volume 4, which is probably going to be just United States history. So you'll have three volumes of world history, and then Volume 4 will be like your Columbus up to the modern period United States history.
Awesome. Now, we talked about your writing style, about how that sets us apart, but something else sets this series apart, I think, and that is the perspective it's looked at through. And we talked about, when we were talking about your book, Heroes and Heretics, that, you know, the Reformation period can be seen through one lens as one thing and another lens as another. But the key point of the story of civilization, I think, is the Catholic perspective the history is being viewed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And obviously, when you're looking at history, you're never just looking at what happened, but you're looking at what those events mean also in the big picture and how they are interconnected. And once you start interpreting history, you know, you're going to have some kind of worldview that you're coming at it from. You're either going to interpret it through, you know, a Marxist view or a military view or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to admit that, as long as you do admit that. As long as you don't try and say, oh, I don't have any worldview I'm coming at this from, except I am.
Yeah.
So obviously, the story of civilization comes at history from a Catholic perspective. It sees the progresses of Catholic civilization as being true goods, and it sees the erosion of Christian civilization as being a negative in the world, and it tries to connect those things and show how, okay, the further the modern world strayed from Christian truth, the more we got these results, and this is kind of how things fall together. And so, but at the same time, it doesn't, you know, we try not to get too pessimistic about the modern world. Obviously, medieval civilization was built on the ashes of a dying empire, and that sort of thing can certainly happen again. So, but yeah, we take the view that God's providence is the ultimate agent behind all things that are happening in this world and in history.
So another thing I wanted to give you time to do here, this segment, is to talk about, as we close down this episode, is talk about, which you briefly did touch upon, your work with Homeschool Connections.
Yeah, so I've been with Homeschool Connections almost 10 years now, and I teach high school history and middle school history and a bunch of other social studies related things for them. If you have not used Homeschool Connections or are familiar with it, it's an online educational company. It's a la carte, so there's no, you sign up and you take whatever classes you want. You don't have to take a whole curriculum or anything. I have kids that take all their history with me through their whole high school, and I have kids that just take me for one class because they're missing a credit somewhere, and that's fine. You can sign up for live classes. You know, every semester I'll teach certain classes live, and you can take my classes live, or you can pay $30 a month and you get access, unlimited access to all the recorded classes, so you can watch them. And there's over, I think there's 250 of them, not mine, I mean all the mm-hmm. teachers there. Then you pay $30 a month, you get unlimited access to all those recordings. So if you don't want to pay the live fees and you don't mind watching an old recording mm-hmm. and just doing the homework and the readings, you can do it that way. So I personally, I think I've taught 23 or 24 different courses with Homeschool Connections that are available either live or on the recordings. So, I mean, after we get off the phone, I'm going to go teach one on the modern Middle Eastern history. So have all sorts of stuff I teach there. And if you're looking for something to kind of plug into your homeschooling, you maybe your kids are burned out looking at too many books or whatever, and you just need something else to plug in there, I would encourage you to check out Homeschool Connections and see what's available. And I think that your listeners will find that it's very affordable. I think compared to a lot of online programs out there, Homeschool Connections really gives you the best value for the money and has a structure that's really set up to benefit the parents and the mm-hmm. tutors and not bankrupt anybody.
Right. And that's where we first learned of you in my household was through Homeschool Connections. My daughter took at least one of your courses that you taught. So that's how. And then this book series comes out, and your name's on it. We're like, hey, that's the dude from Homeschool Connections.
Oh, that's cool. She's a student. I didn't know.
Yes. So Homeschool. Now, through our conversation here today, it's become keenly obvious to me that you're pretty into history. What drove you to that genre of teaching?
It was almost an accident. I tell this story a lot in my when I go speak at homeschool conferences. I remember I was bored at home one day when I was 12, and I was like rummaging around the basement looking for something to do, and I found my mom's old college textbooks from the 70s, and I pulled out a book, and there was a picture of this weird city on the front. It looked very bizarre. A city that looked like it, and not it was Constantinople. And I was like, wow, that's weird. And so I started flipping through this book, and thankfully it was a heavily illustrated history book. Mm-hmm. And I started looking like, oh, here's the Roman Forum, like here's the pyramids, here's people being burned at the stake, oh, like look at that battle, you know. And I was just like, wow, like this is a lot bigger. I started reading it and just like, wow, this is a lot bigger than the small town I live in. You know, the world is a bigger, more interesting place than just my town and my video games and whatnot. And I started just reading it casually. And as I got to be an adult, I just realized I had a natural kind of talent for digesting history and spitting it back out in a way that people could understand and get engaged with. And so I just kind of fell into it, and that's been over 10 years now.
Hmm. Awesome. So that's about all we have time for today, Philip. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending with us. And two questions.
Can I mention
to close.
Quickly two other Yeah, I wanted to mention two other projects I have coming
up. Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned in the intro that I'm doing work with the Catholic Textbook Project. Mm-hmm. I have a textbook on them on, they're doing a series of regional histories for the United States, so I will have, I wrote the book on the Great Lakes, so if you are in a school or a Catholic school that does, like, state history, I wrote a book on the history of the Great Lakes region that's going to be coming out next year, and I'm also working with ARCS Publishing right now on a very interesting little niche project on the history of the Philippines, because we have a ton of Filipino Catholics in the United States, and we were like, let's just write the history of the Philippines. And so I'm very stoked about that project.
So for closing thoughts, where can people find the books we mentioned today? And do you have any closing thoughts of your own?
Yeah, Heroes and Heretics and Story of Civilization, everything can be found on the TAN Homeschool or TAN Books websites. You can go to homeschoolconnections.com to learn about my live classes. And I also have a special class that's being offered on recording this year for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. You can go to rendingofchristendom.info, and or is it rendingofchristendominfo.com? I can't remember. Well, look up Rending of Christendom, Philip Campbell, and you should find it.
Yeah,
and I just would encourage everybody to really dig into history. It doesn't have to be boring, and if you had a boring history experience when you were a kid, give it a second chance. It's pretty fascinating, and it can be life-changing if you get the right stuff. So everybody should be reading history.
Awesome. Thank you again, Philip. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic Book Blogger. And until next time, God bless.